Well, misfortune is sometimes good fortune. Depends on how you look at it. We were stuck in traffic. Three lanes became two lanes, became one lane, and it wasn't moving because of all that congestion. So we came late, but you had all this nice kirtan. Another misfortune, and I don't think it's good fortune, is look at this color and look at that color and somehow it's really off color. So, please excuse me, but it's technology isn't doing what it's supposed to do, but at least there's an image. So the topic for today is to discuss chapter 12 of Bhagavad Gita. And what I think I'll do is I'll do a little background, make a little summary, and then show you the off-color PowerPoint presentation. The message is still there, it's just the color is weird. So, here's some background. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, a great acharya several centuries ago, and following him, Baladev Vidyabhushan, who wrote the principal commentary that this Bhagavad Gita is following. In fact, in the dedication page, this Bhagavad Gita is dedicated to Baladev Vidyabhushan because of his outstanding Govindabhasya commentary. They describe that Bhagavad Gita, made of 18 chapters, has three main subject matters, of which one of those three is the main. So, how much is 18 divided by 3?
6.
I'm looking at your son. He's a math whiz. Is he right? 18 divided by 6? 18 divided by 3? Is 6? Okay. That means 6 plus 6 plus 6 is 18. So they explain that the first 6 chapters are mainly dealing with the subject of how to do work in this world that releases you from bondage to this world. Karma Yoga. Nishkam Karma. And the final 6 chapters That's very interesting. It doesn't change the color. Okay. Whatever the reason. Knowledge that was already presented is presented in greater detail because some persons are inclined to very deeply study subject matters, and therefore gyan, more detailed knowledge than Krishna presents on the subject matters that are essential for the previous two-thirds. So karma, jnana yoga in the final 6 chapters. And the middle 6 chapters, the subject of bhakti yoga. At the end of the first 6 chapters of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna has presented a number of the steps leading up to the 6th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, which is dhyan yoga or meditation, fixing the mind upon the Absolute Truth, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, dhyan yoga. At the end of that dhyan yoga chapter, In a summary way, Krishna says, of all the different elevating activities that one can do, by all means become a yogi. And of all the forms of yoga, the one that is best amongst all the forms of yoga is Shadhavan Bhajate Yomam Same Yukta Uttama Mataha. Mataha means is my opinion. It's a very gentlemanly way of saying this is the way it is. When we say it's my opinion, you can take it or leave it. When Krishna says it's my opinion, it's fact. And in his opinion, the uttama, the topmost form of yoga, is where shraddha van. Van means one who possesses. Like Bhagavan, Krishna possesses bhagas or opulences, etc. So, Shraddha Van, one who possesses faith, Bhajate, the word Bhaj is the root word for bhakti. Bhaj means where there's practical activity, where senses, explicitly, senses are engaged with objects of the senses. And behind that activity is a devotion to the Supreme. Some people think bhakti or devotion to the Supreme is like what you feel. It certainly includes something that you feel. You feel something. But it's, then you do something when you feel something. When you love someone, you do something. And those activities of love and devotion to the Supreme is what makes up bhaja or bhakti. So at the end of chapter 6, Krishna has built a little series of descriptions of forms of yoga that lead to bhakti. So the middle 6 chapters, I'm doing this because chapter 12 is at the end of the middle 6 chapters. What's 6 times 2? 12. So this is chapter 12. This is the end of the bhakti section of Bhagavad Gita. So in chapter 12, in these middle 6 chapters in general, the subject of bhakti, how to, because at the beginning of, chapter 7, beginning of the bhakti section, Krishna says to Arjuna, he's making a promise or a commitment that I am now going to explain how you can practice this topmost form of yoga and achieve the ultimate goal of all the yoga systems. So this is a how-to section. And chapter 12 is going to summarize. Naturally, you're finishing something and you've said, basically you said it already, but now you're going to summarize it. So it comes in the form of a question. The beginning of chapter 12 is a question. And the rest is an answer to that question. And it's a question that Arjuna has asked Krishna twice before, in a different way, but it's the same question. Can you think of, well, you can think of two different ways to see if you get a little audience participation here. When someone is trying to make progress towards the spiritual side of life, what's perhaps the biggest obstacle in going towards the spiritual side of life? Attachment for the material side of life. We may feel right about, believe, have conviction in it's good that my life moves in a more spiritual direction. But we're attached to so many things that are temporary and illusory and still trying to become the enjoyers of those things. So it makes it hard. I'll express it this way. Same thing, just anecdotal. One time I was attending a home program gathering like this in Nashville, Tennessee. And it was a nice family, congregation member family, and it was the first time they had conducted such a gathering in their home. And they were really excited. They said, 30 people have agreed to come. 30 families have agreed to come. And I said, I don't want you to be disappointed, but please understand what happens is when you invite so many people, of those people that agreed to come, half of them will come. And of those that agreed to come, most of them will come towards the end. She said, oh, no, 30 families have said they come. Okay. And because it was new, all very new people, so please make this 101, Krishna Consciousness 101. Very, very simple introductory. Okay. And sure enough, when it was time for the program, the host was there. And the committed practicing devotees were there, and none of their 30 families were there. Not one. And just as, it's just standard, half of them came towards the end. So I thought, okay, I'll do something that's very introductory. And then when they come in, they can hear this introductory thing going on. And something that all families like is you teach the kids, and they think, oh, this is really good. The kids are going to learn something. But actually, it's for the adults. So this is what we did. I had all the kids sit in the front. And I said, okay, I'm going to ask you a question. And don't just blurt out the answer. You got to raise your hand. You got the answer. And it's okay, here's the question. You're going along the path of life. And you're hoping that it's going to be very nice and enjoyable. And sure enough, it's not. So you try to adjust things this way, and you try to adjust things that way, and some unwanted things keep happening. And not only it happens one time and another time, it keeps happening and keeps happening. And then birth after birth, it keeps happening and keeps happening. And at some point, you just decide, hey, wait a minute. This isn't a good program. I want to do a U-turn and go back. I want to go back to Krishna. I thought I would find happiness separate from God. But there is no such thing as happiness separate from God. Happiness is in relation to God. I want to go back to God. But it's not so easy just to snap your fingers and say, okay, I'm going to do a U-turn. Why not? You know, they were all giggly and raising their hands. You got an answer? Go ahead.
Because they're too attached to
you. Yeah, you were listening earlier. Very good. But I didn't give the preamble. Thank you for listening well. I didn't give the preamble for these kids. So they were saying silly things, you know, kid things. And then one little girl, she maybe was 4 years old, right in front, while the other kids are giggling and, you know, laughing, and just calmly raised her hand. She said, the soul says I want to go to God, but the senses say I want to enjoy. I said, wow. And then another boy said, right after her, I said, and the mind says, I don't want to give up my independence. Okay, you got the answer. So, too much attached to sense enjoyment and mental speculation. These two things. In order to... One reporter once asked our spiritual master, Swamiji, how long does it take to become Krishna conscious. Without hesitating, he said, it can happen at once. In less than a moment, one can become fully Krishna conscious. In that less than a moment, two things. The tendency to want to be the enjoyer of sense objects, you have to let go of that. And the other is the tendency to want to understand the truths of life and reality by the process of mental speculation. You have to give that up. Then it paused and said, generally people are attached to these two things, so generally the becoming Krishna conscious is gradual. Then he repeated, but all it takes is less than a moment. So Arjuna, we know, is very dear devotee and a very dear friend of Krishna. Krishna confirms, bhaktosi me sakha cheti. You're my bhakta and my very dear sakha or friend. Therefore I'm explaining this science to you. So Arjuna is taking the position of one of us. And it's purposeful. Prabhupada explains that Krishna arranged like this, that Arjuna could become bewildered about what is his duty of life. In the same way that a mother, those of you that are married, a mother might want to instruct the daughter-in-law by instructing the daughter in the presence of the daughter-in-law. So the daughter-in-law doesn't feel, oh, my mother-in-law is getting on my case. The daughter-in-law sees the mother is instructing the daughter. This is important for the mother-in-law. She's telling the daughter, so now I know what I should do. Similarly, Krishna is instructing Arjuna because he wants to instruct us. But we don't like to take instruction from anybody. Certainly not Krishna, because we're here in the material world to enjoy independently of Krishna. But Krishna is instructing Arjuna. Arjuna is taking the position of one of us. And three times, he asks the same question. Because the question is pursuant to being very attached to being an enjoyer in this world. And if there's some idea of spirituality, commonly that idea of spirituality is you give the whole thing up. You give up material existence and become renounced, take sannyas, become a monk. I mean, that's no, in our Western culture, that's the notion. If you're very serious about some spirituality, the phrase in the English vernacular is, you renounce all your worldly possessions and become a monk. But Krishna doesn't say to Arjuna, renounce all your worldly possessions and become a monk. Arjuna wants to do that. And Krishna is saying, no. You stay in your position and perform your prescribed duty and always think of me. In the Bhagavatam's language, it's sthane stitat shruti gatam tanavan manogir. You stay in your position. Arjuna was a kshatriya. Each of us are whatever we are. And in that position, engage in the activity of hearing. Shruti. You hear the transcendental messages, the sound vibrations of transcendence. And fix your consciousness upon that message. Like the message of Bhagavad Gita. So, the issue that's the context of Bhagavad Gita is a battle. Arjuna is a warrior. The Kauravas have acted in such a way, they're not just bad, particularly Duryodhana, but, you know, attempted murder multiple times, disgracing Draupadi, a number of things, each one of them by laws of Manu, they're punishable by death. Multiple attempted murders. But Arjuna doesn't want to fulfill that by fighting. And he gives all his nice moral reasons. And they're good reasons from a moral perspective, if you don't think about laws of Manu and the soul and so forth. So, Krishna speaking in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita about the soul is different than the body, Sankhya philosophy, and then he speaks about Buddhi Yoga. That's where the intelligence is singular and fixed upon one thing. That's Buddhi. Ekeha Kurunandana. Vyavasayatmika Buddhi Ekeha Kurunandana. Intelligence is singular, one thing. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is to be pleased by whatever I do. And that means if there's something that's not pleasing to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, I don't do it. That's the determining on and off switch. The one and the zero switch. The binary function of the mind. What I accept and what I reject is what's pleasing to Krishna, what's not pleasing to Krishna. Guided by spiritual intelligence. So at the end of that chapter, he indicates to Arjuna, armed with yoga, stand and fight. So the very beginning verse, I'm going to read it, chapter 3, text number 1, Arjuna says, O Janardana, O Keshava, why do you want me to engage in this ghastly warfare if you think that intelligence is better than fruitive work? And intelligence is better than fruitive work. But there's, what he doesn't get is Buddhi Yoga. Buddhi Yoga is where you engage the senses in practical activity with sense objects pursuant to the codes of Dharma or theistic conduct. You do and you don't do according to theistic conduct. And you're guided by intelligence. So he's thinking that working in this world, whether you're a kshatriya, or you're an office worker, or you're a housewife, or you're a student, or there's always going to be things where unintentional, unavoidable, others are going to suffer because you exist. Just that you exist. Others are going to be inconvenienced by your existence. So what's a good person to do? Go out of existence? You can't go out of existence because you're a spirit soul, you exist. You have to do something. That's discussed in chapter 3, Bhagavad Gita, in response. But Krishna, Arjuna, he has a predisposition. What's the predisposition? He doesn't want to fight. You ever had the experience, you've all had the experience, I'm sure, having a conversation with someone where you're trying to explain something that's very simple and they don't get it? And you try it this way, and you try it that way, and you try it another way, and it's still, they don't get it. And why don't they get it? The answer is they don't want to get it. They're predisposed to something else. And that was Arjuna's position. He was predisposed. I don't want to perform my duty. So he's looking for whatever the reason to not perform his duty. And Krishna is saying, Buddhi Yoga, with intelligence, perform your duty. So then Krishna answers his question. He's already explained it in chapter 2. That's the contents of the Gita summarized. And Krishna answers it. And then again he presents the same thing in chapter 4 of Bhagavad Gita, where he's presenting directly knowledge about himself. And he concludes chapter 4, Therefore, the doubts which have arisen in your heart out of ignorance should be slashed with the weapon of knowledge, armed with yoga, bharata, stand and fight. Because Krishna again has been speaking about the strength of knowledge. Knowledge is so amazing. Like unlimited amounts of fuel can be burned by fire, so all the sins of a living entity can be extinguished by the fire of knowledge. And Arjuna's thinking, yes, knowledge. Let me go to the forest and become fixed in knowledge and get away from this awful battlefield. One can easily cross over the ocean of material existence on the boat of transcendental knowledge. Yes, transcendental knowledge. I'll go study the Vedanta and go live in a cave and be peaceful and not have this awful warfare. But now Krishna is saying, knowledge, knowledge, knowledge. Armed with knowledge, stand and fight. So, chapter 5. Second time he's asking the same question. Arjuna said, oh, Krishna, first of all, you asked me to renounce work. He didn't say renounce work. He said renounce the fruits of work. He just didn't hear very well. Arjuna is wanting to renounce work. Krishna is saying, don't renounce work. Renounce the fruits of work. One of the most well-known verses of all of Bhagavad Gita. I've learned this over time, especially amongst Gujaratis, is karmanyevadikaraste ma phaleshu kadachana. Very famous. Ask person, what's the, if it's, they're not familiar with Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita. If you ask somebody that's familiar with Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita, they refer to 1866. Sarvadharmam parityaja mamekam sharanam braja aham tam sarva papibhyo moksha yashami masucha. That's at the end. That's chapter 18. This other is chapter 3, where Krishna is saying, you're entitled to perform your duty, but you're not entitled to the fruits of your duty. Never consider yourself to be the cause of the fruits of your work, because then you think, well, I can be the enjoyer of the fruits of my work because it's mine. I caused it. It's mine. Never consider like that. So Arjuna is saying, you have encouraged me to renounce work. No, he's encouraged him to renounce the fruits of work. And then again, you recommend work with devotion. Now will you kindly tell me definitely which of the two is more beneficial? Very straightforward question. And he gets a straightforward answer. Work and devotion. Because renouncing work, the modes of nature are going to impel you to work. Unless you're a transcendentalist completely situated above the modes of nature, you'll be impelled to work. You can't renounce work. And the fruits of work, when it's done in a system of yoga, the fruits belong to the Supreme. In yajna or sacrifice, you offer the fruits to the Supreme. So, Krishna answers the question again. And now, third time, there must be a reason why he's asking the same question three times. And that's because we don't get it. And we don't get it because we're attached to some other idea. First, it's the idea of being an enjoyer of material existence. But what happens when you've realized, like this little discussion with the kids in Nashville, Tennessee, that you can't just do a U-turn. You can't just renounce the world. Because what is that? That is impersonal. And we're persons. What does one who is renounced from this world do? If you become enlightened, what do you do? I remember as a young boy growing up in a Christian family in America, I asked that question. I asked it in a different way. The question was, the Bible speaks of the kingdom of God. What's it like there? What do people do? What does God do with the people that are there in the kingdom of God? What's it like? And all I got was laughter. Oh, that's a cute question. So I stopped asking the question. It was just dismissed. But what do? In that state of oneness with the Supreme, what is your existence? Do you just twinkle? What do you do? So, what you do is activities in relation to the Supreme. That's what bhakti is. So at the beginning of chapter 12, so now that's just background. We're at the beginning of chapter 12 now. Arjun wants to know, of the two forms of possible worship, which do you consider to be best? Which do you recommend for me? The worship of your impersonal or the worship of your personal feature? What is considered to be more perfect? Those who are always properly engaged in your devotional service or those who worship the impersonal Brahman, the unmanifested? Because there's work and the implications in work, all of which has been discussed in the first six chapters of Bhagavad Gita, because that's the subject. Detached work, or karma phala tyag, working without attachment. So you have to be attached to something, be attached to the Supreme while you're working. And be detached from the fruits of your work and offer that to the Supreme. That's the first portion of Bhagavad Gita with great detail. So if one does like that, one may be thinking the Supreme is this impersonal feature, and the sacrifice or yajna is unto that, Brahman. And my goal is to become one with Brahman. So Arjun wants to know, is that best? Or is engaging in devotional service on this plane, physical plane, and in the transcendental plane, which is best? So that's how chapter 12 begins, and now I'm going to summarize chapter 12. Krishna says, very clear answer to the very clear question, devotional service is best. Then he gives two reasons why. One is, it's very difficult to fix your mind upon something that has no form, no qualities, no personality, no name. Even to think of such a thing, what to fix your mind on such a thing. How do you do it? Very difficult. And thus, it's unnatural, but the other is very natural. It's what souls do in the liberated state. They engage in activities unto the Supreme, devotional activities in service to the Supreme. And the other reason he gives, that one is unnatural, the other is very natural. So it's better. The other is very difficult, practically impossible. It's unnatural. The other reason he gives is, Krishna helps you. So it's a very simple mathematical equation. Which is greater, your effort or your effort plus Krishna's help? Real easy. And when you reach to Krishna for Krishna's help, Krishna gives us help. If you don't reach to Krishna for Krishna's help, he doesn't interfere. He wants to help, but he doesn't interfere with the free will of the living entity. He wishes to help, but you're saying no. So it doesn't interfere. So bhakti is specifically where one is turning to the personality of Godhead. I am your eternal servant. I wish to serve you. I wish to have the strength to properly serve you, to have the intelligence to know how to properly serve you, to have strong faith to stay fixed in that service. Krishna, please help me. Whatever undertaking, whatever endeavor is our effort plus descending mercy. The fullness of this Krishna's descending mercy. So it's stronger. That's the first of three sections. The second section is where we'll spend most of our time. It's where there's a descending order of spirituality. It's a very important section. Krishna gives the topmost, if you can't do this, do that, if you can't do that, do the other thing, if you can't do that, do the other thing. He's making the sequencing of priorities or stages of elevated consciousness very clear. That's the middle section of chapter 12. It's very important. It's not an ism. You know, this church is better than that church, or this belief is better than that belief, or this ism is better than that ism. It's not about isms. It's principles. And this principle is stronger. And if that can't be done, the next. If that can't be done, the next. Then the final section is sublime. It's Krishna describes to Arjuna those qualities in those who are his devotees that please him very much. And I'll just 2 minutes and we'll get ready for this PowerPoint. According to Rupa Goswami in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, there are so many wonderful qualities that are characteristic of a devotee of the Lord that are found within scripture. And he has analyzed that there are 26 principal qualities. Of these 26 principal qualities, one is primary and the other 25 are secondary. So the primary one is Krishna Eka Sharana. Sharana means surrendered. Completely surrendered to Krishna. Completely attached to Krishna. That's this Bodhi Yoga that I mentioned earlier. Vyavasayatmika Bodhi Ekeha Kuru Nandana. One thing. The Supreme, the Beloved, the Supremely Beloved Person. That's the most important. And following behind that Swarup Lakshana, the principal characteristic, are Tatastha Lakshana, the marginal characteristics. The example is given like a queen is provided many attendants or ladies-in-waiting or whatever the language in different cultures is. And as she moves about the palace, they follow around and whatever she wants, they take care of. But the chaste and faithful queen, she's not interested in the ladies-in-waiting and all that they can provide. She's interested in one thing, the king. That's her qualification as the queen. Because of that qualification, she has all these attendant features, the ladies, to help her. And similarly for a devotee, the principal thing is love for Krishna. And when Krishna sees that, he then decorates his devotees with nice qualities. And when the devotee comes before Krishna with those nice qualities, he's very pleased. But where do those good qualities come from? They came from Krishna. It's an exchange of love. Krishna gives and Krishna is happy. And the devotee likes to please Krishna and Krishna gives the means to please Krishna. It's love. And that's the end of chapter 12. It's the end of that middle sixth section also, Bhagavad Gita. Okay, so ready to begin. I'll just say it again one final time. The background here is nice, kind of pink. It looks like marble texture, and that looks like something else. So the colors are not at all matching. My apology. But what to do? Chapter 12 follows chapter 11. And so at the very beginning, you'll hear the speakers speaking a little summary of what chapter 11 that leads into chapter 12.
To protect innocent people from imposters, Arjuna asks Krishna to prove his divinity by exhibiting his universal form, a form that anyone who claims to be God should be prepared to show.
And that's chapter 12, is the universal form. So?
Krishna gives Arjuna divine vision by which to see the brilliant, glaring, unlimited universal form, which reveals in one place everything that ever was, or now is, or will be.
And on the left side, that's the universal form, or at least an artist's rendering of it. So in one place, Krishna seated on the chariot, and Krishna showing the universal form of Krishna. That is, everything that exists in all time, in all place, in one place. It's like circuit overload. How do you encompass all of that?
At that time, Arjuna could see in the universal form of the Lord the unlimited expansions of the universe situated in one place, although divided into many, many thousands.
Can you adjust the projector so the left side is visible? A little more. Just turn it. Not back, just turn it. Okay, thank you.
Arjuna offers obeisances with folded hands and glorifies the Lord. Arjuna requests Krishna to withdraw his fearful form and show his original form. The Lord then exhibits his four-armed form, and at last, his original two-armed form. Upon seeing the Lord's beautiful human-like form, Arjuna becomes pacified. Only one engaged in pure devotional service can see such a form.
So seeing those forms, universal form, four-arm form, two-arm form, leads to Arjuna's question, which is the beginning of chapter 12.
Chapter 12, devotional service.
And as indicated, there are three sections. So there's the question that leads off the chapter, which is more perfect, personal or impersonal worship.
Arjuna inquired, which are considered to be more perfect? Those who are always properly engaged in your devotional service, or those who worship the impersonal Brahman, the unmanifested?
Very clear, direct question, and so is the answer.
The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, those who fix their minds on my personal form and are always engaged in worshipping me with great and transcendental faith are considered by me to be most perfect.
Body control. Your body control. You're in the understanding.
Did we put in the right
one? Ah, here it is.
Oh.
Okay, good enough.
But those who fully worship the unmanifested, that which lies beyond the perception of the senses, the all-pervading, inconceivable, unchanging, fixed and immovable, the impersonal conception of the absolute truth, by controlling the various senses and being equally disposed to everyone, such persons, engaged in the welfare of all, at last achieve me.
So there's one of the reasons why this is preferred, bhakti is preferred.
For those whose minds are attached to the unmanifested, impersonal feature of the Supreme, advancement is very troublesome. To make progress in that discipline is always difficult for those who are embodied.
Second reason.
But those who worship me, giving up all their activities unto me, and being devoted to me without deviation. Engaged in devotional service and always meditating upon me, having fixed their minds upon me, O son of Pitha. For them, I am the swift deliverer from the ocean of birth and death.
So there's Lord Vishnu riding on the back of Garuda, and one who is in the ocean of material existence, wishing relief from the ocean of material existence. It's not just one's effort, but descending mercy. The Supreme Lord delivers such a soul who, in devotion, is depending upon him. This is the, it's hard to see it very clearly in this image, but there's Ajamila. Surrounding Ajamila are the Yamadutas. And because Ajamila has called the name of his son Narayana, the messengers of Narayana have appeared. Although his intention was otherwise, and he wasn't calling Lord Narayan, just calling the name, intending his son Narayan, the Narayana Dutas or Vishnu Dutas appeared and protected Ajamila. So, Krishna has indicated which of the two is superior. Then he's going to go in this descending way from the stage of the topmost, gradually progressing downward. Stages of perfection.
Just fix your mind upon me, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and engage all your intelligence in me. Thus, you will live in me always, without a doubt.
So that's the perfection. In the previous two slides is what we practice using our mind, intelligence, and our senses. And Krishna's statement is, by that method, the spiritual world is opened for you. But supposing someone says, I don't think I can do that. Always have my mind fixed upon Krishna, always my intelligence engaged in that way. What about me? So Krishna answers,
my dear Arjuna, O winner of wealth, if you cannot fix your mind upon me without deviation, then follow the regulative principles of Bhakti Yoga. This way, develop a desire to attain me.
So if that perfectional stage is beyond your reach, there are regulations that help you at least develop a desire to attain that stage. And that's what the regulations of Bhakti Yoga are. But someone may say, it sounds very good, but I don't know if I can follow those regulations of Bhakti Yoga. What about me? But Krishna says,
if you cannot practice the regulations of Bhakti Yoga, then just try to work for me, because by working for me, you will come to the perfect stage.
That is to say, by working for Krishna, the inclination to follow the regulations of Bhakti will arise, and by following the regulations of Bhakti, the desire to attain Krishna, and thus the perfectional stage, can follow. So there are many people. There are many people that visit in ISKCON, just in that context, visit our temples. And they're not inclined to chant at their home and follow different regulations in their lives. But they like to come to the temple. They like to see the deity. They like to do some service, whatever can be done. And in that way, Krishna is indicating, all right, the regulations of Bhakti Yoga you find a little difficult, that's okay. Then try to work for me. So this is Karma Yoga. There's perfection. There's the stage of regulative Bhakti Yoga, Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti. And then there's Karma Yoga. But that's also described in Bhagavad Gita, in the earlier chapters. But supposing somebody says, oh, I don't know if I can work for Krishna. What about me?
If, however, you are unable to work in this consciousness of me, then try to act, giving up all results of your work, and try to be self-situated.
So there's two things. One of them is, there's working in consciousness of Krishna, but if one cannot do that, then there's being charitable. That's good. You work, there's results of your work, be charitable. Some good cause, give to some good cause the fruits of your work. Better than that is working for Krishna, better than that is the regulations of bhakti, better than that is being fixed in the stage of perfection. But at least be charitable, be detached in that way, and then essential, side by side, is try to be self-situated. And to be self-situated goes back to the earlier discussion in chapter 2 Bhagavad Gita, where the self is spirit soul. There's the covering, the body, and the subtle covering, the mind and intelligence, but then there's the soul itself. So to be self-situated is to be conscious of my real identity as the spark of life that's animating this body. And the body is changing. Here's a small boy, and the small boy becomes a young boy, and the young boy becomes a mature adult and old man, and then kaput, he's gone. The soul leaves the body and goes on to some other situation. So be conscious of the self while you're being charitable and doing your various duties of life. And somebody might say, well, I'm trying to do that, but I'm not finding so much success in doing that. What about me?
If you cannot take to this practice, then engage yourself in the cultivation of knowledge.
And specifically, knowledge, as you see, is scripture. It's try to understand what the self is. Try to understand the distinction between that which is temporary, asat, and that which is eternal, sat, and be fixed in knowledge at least of what's the difference between the two, discriminating between eternal and temporary. And somebody may say, well, I'm not so inclined to do like that. What about me?
Better than knowledge, however, is meditation.
Because in that state of meditation, meditation doesn't just mean go to yoga classes. It means in a concentrated way, keeping focus on the self.
And better than meditation is renunciation of the fruits of action, for by such renunciation one can attain peace of mind.
Now, a nice example of this peace of mind, as you see from the picture, is King Rantidev. This is described in the 9th canto of Bhagavatam, the life of Rantidev. I'll briefly summarize. He was a very magnanimous personality and a great king, loved by everyone, both because he was so pious. His whole kingdom was prospering, and everyone likes to prosper, so they like their king. And people were religious. That's part of another reason why they were religious, because their king was religious and they were following their king. And so the whole country was prosperous. The army was strong. The treasury of the king was very replete and full. At the same time, Rantidev was inclined very specifically to do acts of charity for everybody in his kingdom, although they had their necessities largely. So one time, although he's royal king, enjoying with royal opulence, he decided to engage in a fast, and I'm trying to recall the number of days, and I think it was 100 days. So sometimes we fast for Janmashtami, and that's very nice. By the end of the day, you're feeling fatigued and a little weak, but you know, it's joyful because you're doing devotional service and kirtan and worshipping the deity, and then you break the fast and it's over. So a fast for longer than that and longer than that, and not for political reasons, but for devotional reasons. So his wish was he was going to engage in a 100-day fast, and then upon breaking the fast, the fruits of all of his austerities would go The piety would go to his citizens. That was Ranti Dev. And so, the description in the ninth canto Bhagavatam was that Lord Shiva, Lord Brahma, and Lord Indra, they heard about this magnanimity of King Ranti Dev and they wanted to test it. So they decided to do the following. On the day that Ranti Dev was to fast, the picture on my screen looks a lot better than over there, but they sat him on a royal throne and gave him a royal, big amount of things to eat. And just as he was about to break fast on that auspicious morning, one Brahmin came to the palace. And Ranti Dev was very happy because this auspicious occasion, a Brahmin has come. So he sat the Brahmin down in his own seat and said, "You take first. And whatever is left, I'll take the remnants." So he ate half and gave half left for the king. The king was very happy. So he sat down to take the other half that was left. And just as he was about to sit down, one man came with a bunch of puppies, as you see over here on the left. And he said, "My puppies are hungry. Can I have something for them to eat?" He said, "Surely. No one in my kingdom goes hungry, even puppies. They're also praja. They're born in this kingdom and they're citizens of the kingdom and they should not be hungry. Here, have them take this what's on my plate." And what was left was a goblet that had some water. So the puppies were fed and he sat down to break the fast by drinking water. And one very poor man came just as he was about to drink the water and said, "I'm very thirsty. Can I have some water?" So Ranti Dev gave the thirsty man the water. And then they revealed that their identity were actually Lord Shiva, Lord Brahma, and Lord Indra. They just wanted to see, what's the extent of this king's, is it conditional or unconditional, his charity? It's unconditional. So they praised his quality and said, "Surely for having this quality, you'll be blessed by the Supreme Lord, and at the end of this life, you'll go back to Godhead." So, by renunciation, one, Krishna is indicating here, one can attain peace of mind, even in difficult circumstances. And we all know too well, there's difficult circumstances in embodied life and material existence. Always, it's something or another something or ten somethings. It's always something that's causing provocation to disturb the mind. So how can the mind remain peaceful if you're attached to material existence? It's ever-changing and difficult. So that stage of dhira, where the mind is undisturbed, is where, in principle, the fruits of one's actions are to be offered, not for self-enjoyment, but for, then you go, good cause, for the service of Krishna, under the regulations of bhakti, and ultimately everything is just for him, in progressive stages. So here's,
Krishna's service. One's consciousness is totally fixed on Krishna. A step lower is the practice of regulative devotional service. Lower than that is karma yoga, renouncing the fruits of action. Indirect processes for attaining the Supreme include meditation and cultivating knowledge.
So you could, it's a nice diagram. You can see the steps, and they all lead, if properly followed, to the next, up to the topmost stage. When explaining this chapter in New York City, Prabhupada to a young Western audience, gave the example of the Empire State Building. Fortunately, he didn't use the World Trade Center. He said, supposing you want to go to the top floor of the Empire State Building, there's two methods. You can go on the staircase, or you can ride the elevator. And both will get you. But it's very arduous, and it may be by the end of the day before, and the whole building is closed, and you have to go back down again if you just go up the staircase. Very tiring. But you can ride the elevator, and the same thing will work. So he describes the process of following the regular principles of bhakti yoga. It's the elevator method. Very quickly, the qualifications come to one who follows the regulations of bhakti and attaining the desire, developing the desire to attain Krishna's eternal association as a direct result. But for those who are unprepared to do those, these other steps are provided at the bottom step in the front, showing purification, peace, gradual elevation. Those are indirect and more direct and fully direct progressive stages of devotion. That's the subject matter of chapter 12, Bhagavad Gita. So now we're ready for the final final section. We'll go quickly with this. There are this is who knows who this is? Okay, you two agree. That's good. Who's Sudama? He's a what?
Poor Brahmin.
How did he know Krishna? You kids read the Krishna book, huh? They went to school together. Who was their school teacher? Sandipani Muni. And when did Krishna go to school? 12 years old. Not bad. He didn't even have to go to school until he was 12. Hey, yay! Why did that happen? Because he was living with Nanda and Yashoda in Gokul, and then he came to Mathura. He KO'd Kamsa. He is reunited with his mother and father, Vasudeva and Devaki, and then they immediately, we have to put our son in school. He hasn't gone to school yet. 12 years old, he hasn't gone to school yet. We got to find the best school teacher. And so he went to Sandipani Muni school. And Sudama, Brahmin, and Krishna, a cowherd boy, Vaishya, but the son of the king of the cowherds, Nanda Maharaj, they went to the same school. So they developed wonderful friendship. So as you can see, Sudama isn't very interested in his feet being bathed. And Krishna is interested in bathing his feet, but he's interested in the gazing of loving exchanges with Sudama. So qualities are what is most pleasing to Krishna. Conversely, without good qualifications, we can't be a pure devotee and we can't please Krishna. So there's a statement in the Bhagavatam that says without that first qualification, the Swarup Lakshana, the other good qualifications don't
come. One who is not envious, but is a kind friend to all living entities.
This is Magari, who is a hunter, but once he became a devotee, he doesn't want to hurt ants.
He does not think himself a proprietor and is free from false ego.
This is the king, Prataparudra, who's taking the position of an ordinary street sweeper, serving Lord Jagannath as Lord Jagannath is heading for his rath cart in Puri.
Who is equal in both happiness and distress. Who is tolerant, always satisfied.
This is Maharaj Parikshit, who is bitten by Tathakshaka at the curse of the Brahmin boy Sringi. So he's remaining, as he said before the snake bird came, he was completely ready for anything beyond happiness and distress, fully tolerant, even in the greatest of difficulties.
Self-controlled and engaged in devotional service with determination. his mind and intelligence fixed on me. Such a devotee of mine is very dear to me.
Then, another set. Who's this? Who's that? So this is going to characterize qualities like Prahlad Maharaj, even in the face of very, very great difficulty.
He for whom no one is put into difficulty. And who is not disturbed by anyone. Who is equipoised in happiness and distress, fear and anxiety. Is very dear to me.
And then? Who?
Hanuman.
And when you think of Hanuman, what do you think of? Loyalty to Ram, just wants to serve Ram, fixed in service to Ram. Hanuman.
My devotee who is not dependent on the ordinary course of activities, who is pure, expert, without cares, free from all pains, and not striving for some result, is very dear to me.
And
those who follow this imperishable path of devotional service, who completely engage themselves with faith, making me the supreme goal, are very, very dear to me.
And that's the end of the chapter. Again, my apology for the color. I think next time we'll do a little check on color before we proceed. But Krishna is explaining in this chapter three things, summarize, the superiority of the worship of his personal form, the descending stages of attaining that topmost stage of perfection, and the qualities in his devotees that please Krishna very much. This is very confidential. Krishna is saying what he feels. We might say what we feel, that's confidential. But to know what Krishna feels, it's very confidential. And he's disclosing what he feels about his devotees. So he's called Bhakta Vatsala. He holds it with great affection, those who are his devotees. And that's the end of chapter 12. Okay. Hare Krishna. Your patient audience. Thank you all very much. Any comments or questions you'd like to ask? You want to hit the power? There's prasad and plates to go for those that have to go, looks like. Okay. Any questions? Anyone? Yes?
Kind of curious. So where in the Bible do they describe what happens in the kingdom of heaven?
They don't. That was the question I had and didn't get an answer.
But is there any section in the Bible?
I answered that. Not to my knowledge. That's why I was asking the question. You're supposed to go there, but there's no travel information. You know, go to Acapulco and you know what it's like. Go to Hawaii, go to wherever. Go to the kingdom of God or heaven. No information. Except there's detailed information within the Vedas. The heavenly planets, Vaikuntha planets, Goloka planet. Very detailed description. There's a place in the Bible where Christ says, I am telling you of worldly things and you cannot bear to hear. What to speak of heavenly things? So the audience that he was addressing had limited capacity, and so according to capacity he was giving. And consequently, you were sharing with me, wasn't it your teacher? Yeah, the Bible teacher has these very unusual notions about what heaven is. It's not in the Bible. But heaven is, on the one hand, a place where you serve God and you love God. But heaven, on the other hand, is a place where it's just like it is here without the problems. There's your family, there's Fido, there's turkey on the table, and, you know, it's Thanksgiving. It doesn't say that in the Bible. But that's, he's a teacher of what the Bible says. Math doesn't work. It's one of the two things that one has to let go of. It's actually both of the things that one has to give up: mental speculation and the expectation of sense gratification that comes from the contact of the senses and sense objects. What something else has to fill that space that makes up material life. Heaven isn't just an upgrade. Yeah.
You mentioned the sloka of, you know, that Prabhupada says, the final verse of Gita. What does it mean?
Sarva dharmam parityaja. Tyaja means to give up. Parityaja, completely give up. Sarva dharmam, all varieties of dharma, in place of one thing. Mam ekam sharanam. Surrender unto me alone. Aham tvam sarva papebhyo, one who does like this to such a person, sarva papebhyo, they are freed from the reactions of all sins, moksha yashami, and they achieve the stage of liberation. And if you have any doubt, masuchaha, don't have any doubt, don't worry, I assure you, it's a fact. So, it doesn't mean, what it does mean is what's said. What it doesn't mean is become irreligious and do whatever the heck you want, just say it's in the name of God and it's okay. That's not what it means. One still follows the codes of Dharma, but the purpose behind the codes of Dharma are always considered. And that's principle. It's like, a visual image is like a chandelier, where beautiful crystals are hanging in various nice symmetric patterns and glittering and shining and colors, and it's all hanging from one place. Without that one place, the chandelier isn't beautiful. It's just lying on the ground somewhere. So the one thing that supports all other things within the whole of the Vedas is to achieve this one thing, the position of surrender to Krishna. The Padma Purana teaches it slightly differently, but it's the same message. During Christmas time, I'm going to be in Chicago conducting a seminar with several devotees, and the theme is always remember Krishna, never forget Krishna. Smartavya satatam Vishnur na smartavya na jata chit. Always remember Krishna, never forget Krishna, under any circumstance. And that's this one principle is the principle that all other principles are in pursuance of. All other religious principles are in pursuance of this one principle. That's Padma Purana. And the way it's described in Bhagavad Gita is one thing, Mam Ekam Sharanam. And one who has this one thing, all other desirable things follow. But you may have so many desirable things, but without this one thing, they amount to so many zeros. You put a 1 in front of a 0, it becomes 10. When a 1 in front of 2 zeros, it becomes 100. Have as many zeros as you like, but make sure there's the 1 in front. This one thing. Something else? Yes.
You said you were told that God doesn't interfere with the freedom of the soul, but we see his dear devotees on that table point, messengers. They see someone using that freedom wrongly. They try to rescue them.
The devotee may do like that, but Krishna doesn't. He's very intelligent. And even the devotee can't like force someone. He just reminds them, hey, you're heading for the ditch. Get back to the middle of the road. It's very dangerous over there. Like that.
Is that the reason we say a devotee of Lord is more merciful than
Yes. God? Yes. You say like that. Okay. So let's have some more kirtan. We'll sing a little bit more while they're getting all the prasadam together, and if you need to get up and move around, that's okay too. You can take, we'll serve prasadam while we're having kirtan. Is that good?
Yes.
Okay. Get your team together.